It's 8:16 now. Good morning. Well, the Park City Board of Education met on Monday evening for its first strategic planning meeting for this round, then again on Tuesday morning for a regular school meeting, at which point they elected Andrew Kaplan to serve as new school board president. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning, Andrew.
Morning, Leslie.
So now that you're president, you're also spokesman for the school board. Let's talk a little bit about that.
I tend to be on the radio quite a bit. I won't be the spokesperson. Melinda Colton, our communications director, has that role. But I'll be on the radio quite a bit, as will some of the other board members. And the same goes for comments to the park record. We will be a little bit more structured, though, in how we're communicating to the public. And that's a focus of the board and something that was discussed on Monday evening and will continue to be a focus for us.
Yeah, we were given the impression, though, that you would be the one doing all of the KPCW radio interviews. And I guess that's just, that really goes against our mission in terms of holding public officials accountable, especially since you don't represent me on the school board. I would vote for somebody else. And so I don't get to talk to her on the radio. I don't understand what you guys are doing.
Well, I think, one of the things that we've heard from the community is we have an issue with communication. And that's something that goes back to the bond failure in 2015. We had a meeting on Monday night with the community, and about 60 people from the community showed up. You were there. One of the things that came up repeatedly was a lack of proper communication. And one of the things that we've heard is that there's a lack of a consistent message. It's unclear what the board's direction is. It's unclear what we're trying to do. And so we're going to try some different things. Certainly what we don't want to do is give not hold elected officials accountable. They're always accountable. They're accountable to all of the constituents and voters. But in terms of our messaging and our communication as a district and as a board, we're making some changes. And one of those changes was hiring, a director of communications in Melinda, who has a tremendous amount of experience in communication. And another thing that we're going to do is try to streamline our messaging to the community. Our goal is not to become harder to reach. It's actually the opposite. But I think we're going to, each of us are going to take certain responsibilities and play to our strengths and try to send the right message out to the community, because what we've been doing hasn't been working. So.
Yeah, but how do I know if my school board member is representing me if I never get to hear what she thinks? And she's up for re-election next fall.
Look, I think there's a lot of ways that we can communicate with the public, and that we do. All of our school board meetings are recorded and published online. All of us as school board members are, our emails and phone numbers are published online, and we're always available to constituents. The reality is that once we're elected, yes, we represent certain neighborhoods, but once we're elected, we're responsible to all constituents in the, in the district, and we're responsible for overseeing, the activities of all the students. So, while I live in the Trailside and Parley's encatchments, the decisions I make and the votes I make also affect what happens in Pinebrook and Jeremy and Summit Park, et cetera, and vice versa. When JJ makes a vote, it affects the kids in Old Town. So we're all in this together. And certainly, when it comes to elections, that's the ultimate referendum on what people think about their elected officials. And, the public always, speaks through elections. And we know that in our town and nationwide.
Yeah. But isn't that how good decisions are made, when we actually have some dissension among the board and different ideas? If we have a spokesperson like you telling us what the board thinks, I don't know how the other board members think.
I think we do, right? We're very transparent. All of our business is conducted in public. And that's something that not a lot of people, understand or recognize. But, in our board meetings, that's when we discuss policy. That's when we discuss views. That's when we review the facts and make our decisions. And so, all of that is public. The transcripts are public. The videos are public. And, it's that's how we do things, right? Nothing is happening behind closed doors, or, you know, it's very obvious what all of us are thinking and doing.
But how we do things here at KPCW is getting a broad representation of not only city council members, but county council members, planning commissioners, and school board members. And now you've kind of shut that down.
Well,
when? I mean, when you talk about doing things in public, I mean, when was that decision made? I don't ever remember seeing it on an agenda.
In terms of conducting our business in public?
No,
that's by state statute.
In terms of you being spokesperson for the board.
Look, what was discussed and decided in terms of radio is that I'm going to be on. And I'll be honest with you, we all have our own strengths and weaknesses, right? And you do a very good job of asking the difficult questions, and that's why your show is very popular. You know, at our meeting on Monday, there were a lot of things that were said. You know, we want you to continue to be on KPCW. We want you to continue to be communicating through the public. And frankly, Leslie, you ask hard-hitting questions, and some of our members choose to be on the radio and some of us choose to not. And part of that is just the interaction, right? And you know, we're all responsible for responding to constituents and being in public and conducting our business in public. But we also, you know, are all people who have other jobs, right? This is a volunteer board position, and we all have various time constraints. We all have various skills that we do. And, you know, it's the reality, right? It's a part-time job where we're all trying to do the best we can for kids. And, you know, if certain people don't want to be on the radio, or certain people don't want to speak to the park record, or certain people do, then, you know, we're going to let that happen. We're not going to force people to do things they're uncomfortable doing.
Let's go back to Monday night. As I mentioned, this was the first strategic planning meeting for this go-around. We've got three new board members. You're one of them. And I don't know if you weren't attending school board meetings or just didn't pay attention to the last go-around that we spent over a year of master planning meetings. We're doing it all over again. You're saying we're doing this because of the bond failure?
No, and actually you were there, so you know that we're not doing it all over again.
I didn't get there until very late.
Okay, yeah. So that's actually not accurate at all. What the case is that we've spent, you know, the community members and school board members have spent probably in the thousands of hours post the bond failure reviewing strategic planning. And there's been a lot of wonderful work done by many, many community members in terms of strategic planning and planning for the district. What's happened is that that planning has kind of stalled out, and it reached a point where when the strategic planning committee came to the board and gave their recommendations, action needed to be taken in order to continue that process and move forward. And action was not taken. And so what we're saying is we're saying, okay, you know what, as a board, we screwed up. We didn't take strategic planning forward and see it through till the end, which we needed to do post 2015. And now we're going to complete that process. And by completing it, we're just having a refresh. We're showing the data and the themes that came from that previous work. We're giving them to the public and the community in various forums. And we're going to make sure that still remains the community's values. And then we're going to move forward. But we're not starting over by any means.
So the plans to expand the high school, to realign our grades, to go to a two-bill schedule, those are moving forward now with this?
Or? So those are not part of strategic planning. Strategic planning, you know, and this is something that I've come to learn recently, there's a difference between strategic planning and master planning. Strategic planning is understanding the core values of our district. What do our community members want for the schools? What do they value? Then when we get into master planning, it's more about things like what you're mentioning, grade realignment, et cetera, what our buildings look like, what our classrooms look like, what the curriculum looks like, et cetera. So that's the next step in this process. And, you know, are we going to throw out the work that's been done before? Absolutely not. That would be disrespectful, I think, to all the people who have come before and put in a lot of time. But what we are going to do is make sure that the entire process is conducted in the public. And what we've learned is that the way we were doing things earlier, Leslie, didn't work. Okay. We know they didn't work because in 2015, we got a resounding no. We know they haven't been working because this summer when we did a bond survey, a pre-bond survey, we got a maybe. not, you know, and it was that was without any kind of public input. So we know that the way we've been doing things isn't right, and jumping to conclusions or leaving it up to the administration to dictate what the buildings look like doesn't work for our community. So what we're going to do is we're going to conduct this process. We're going to refresh the work that's been done in public. We're going to conduct everything we do in public, and we're going to make sure that by the time that we get to a decision around facilities and a bond, the public already knows what they want, and they've told us what they want, and that's what we'll be voting on, not something that comes from the district.
You told the audience, and not you specifically, but there were 5,000 data points that you had mm-hmm. used to prepare for Monday's meeting. Mm-hmm. So what happens now that you have five more lengthy lists to add to those?
It's not new information. You know, the things that we discussed, the five values, and those are posted on our website, are coming from all of that data. So there was, you know, the strategic planning, project that I discussed. There was the What Counts meetings. There was an extensive teacher survey done. There's the pre-bond survey. There's all kinds of things that have been done in the last 2 years. What we talked about Monday night was just the ideas that percolated up from that. And there was consistent themes like having excellent educators, you know, better communication, leadership accountability, core values that outside of the obvious, which is academics, you know, our community cares about. And so it's not new information. We're not bringing new things to the table. We're simply organizing and distilling them so that it's clear to everyone what we're looking at. And then that's the way we're going to move forward.
Enrollment count was official on Monday. We're down some 68 students, I think. So mm-hmm. that's three classrooms across the district. That's a $580,000 loss in WPU money.
Yep.
I think what I heard is that gets made up from reserves.
Yeah, so we ended up with a slightly larger account balance at the end of this past fiscal year, so that will equal out. But it's about $580,000 in WPU money. But we pretty much self-fund, right? So on a net basis, we're paying out to the state anyways. So having that difference is not going to make or break our budget.
But when we talk about reserves, I mean, how much do we have in reserves? Because my understanding is that we were using reserves to pay for the teacher salaries this year.
So we have quite a bit in reserves. Our goal as a district is to have enough for 2 to 3 months of operating in our reserves. By statute, we're allowed to have 5% of our operating budget in reserves, and then we tend to have about 20%. In reserves. So our reserves have been growing over the past 5 years from around 17% to 20% of budget. We always are planning on spending that down. We've been looking at facilities for quite some time, as you know, and part of the thought process there is that we're keeping that money to spend on facilities. With regards to the teacher salaries, that is going to come, you know, year one, it's coming from what we have, and going forward, as we look at our budget, when we're starting that process for next year, like other municipal groups in town, we're going to be looking at a tax increase. And, what's reassuring is when we talk to the community, one of the things that always comes up is we care about our teachers and we want our top-notch educators. And I think the community is fine paying for that.
The kindergarten numbers, you noticed, were smaller than the senior class numbers. Does that suggest that we've got an upcoming population reduction in our schools? Are we not growing like we thought we
were? Well, we're looking at it. There's a lot of interesting things that came out in the enrollment. The elementaries were actually on the whole up. The secondary, you know, from Treasure and the high school, they were actually down. Kindergarten did look a little bit off. One of the things that we're doing that's been asked for by the community, you know, as we move forward in our planning, is to do a full demographic study. And that's something we haven't done for a while. So we're going to, you know, we're in the process of doing an RFP for a demographics company to come in and give us an assessment. We need to look at what the buildable areas are, what the themes are in terms of, you know, second homeowners selling to primaries, if there's young families moving here. We have a lot of anecdotal evidence. We have evidence from the real estate agents in town, but we need to get some real hard data to help inform our decisions going forward.
Big discussion on closing schools. Board member Petra Butler said that she had heard that 25% of the kids at McPullen are from out of district. Is that true? Or?
No, not out of district. I think from intra-district. And we know what our out of district numbers are. you know, there's two components of that. One is our the kids who belong to teachers or employees of the district, and we don't really factor that in because that's a right and a privilege of our employees. The number is about 5%, I think, overall of our students coming from out of district. And again, there's state statute, which is very clear about what we can and can't do in terms of restricting kids, you know, from coming into our district. But, you know, it's interesting, you know, we have one closed school, which is Jeremy. The other elementaries remain open, and we're actively looking at that, right? A decision has to come in December. We're looking at that. We have to make an assessment based on what spaces in the schools are teachable and make sure that also is in line with policy in terms of which specials are pull in versus pull out, things like that. So there's a lot to look at. We also recognize, though, as a board and a community, that most of our schools have trailers. And so it's very difficult for us to have trailers at all of our schools and say, oh, yes, they're open and we have plenty of space for more kids.
Let's talk briefly about the Communities of Caring presentation that was made. And it pointed out how many people in Summit County are struggling with mental illness on a daily basis. The results of the Summit County Mental Health Survey showed some 8,000 adults struggling and something like 1 in 5 kids. Latina girls ages 10 to 17 at most risk for suicidal thoughts. Any idea, any speculation why that is?
I don't. It was an excellent presentation from Aaron Newman and Mary Krista. And we as a district are excited to support that program, and I think we need to do more. I think the debate kind of that started at the meeting was how do we do more as a district and what do we do for the kids? I mean, you know, 26% of kids in Summit County have contemplated suicide at some point. You know, we don't have I didn't get context. Is that higher than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago or not? But regardless of the context, it's a crazy statistic. And the other thing that really kind of hit home for me is that when you have a 160-day waiting list to see a psychologist or someone who can get you medication or help, that is it's just way too long. Right. And we need to do more for the community. And I think as a community, we're coming together and tackling this issue. And the school board is going to be, you know, in the school district. And Dr. Conley and Petra Butler is very involved in this. And it's a priority for us. You know, we're going to be working on it.
Yeah. Well, and that was one of my questions. So, I mean, since that was one of the biggest issues that came out about that getting help, having to wait for getting that help. I mean, what can the school district do about that?
I mean, look, you know, I think it's a philosophical debate that we have to go over, which is what is the school district's role in providing the mental health solutions for the community and for the kids? You know, we could say that, you know, okay, we have the ability to employ doctors legally. You know, we could do that. And there's other school districts that provide health services in communities where they're not available. And that's certainly a possibility. But at the same time, we recognize this is a community issue. And I don't think it would be fair to the rest of the community for us to go it alone, right? We have to work with our partners who are tackling this issue. And Mary Krista pointed out that there's a study going on in a committee that's actually looking at the best way to resource our community. And I think the district is going to be part of that. I'd like to see the district part of that. And we're going to continue to work with her and the Communities of the Care group and find some solutions. Because what I can say is 100%, the current situation is unacceptable, right? I mean, we cannot have, you know, someone who needs mental help to get, you know, to wait 160 days. When you need help, you know, you need it today. You don't need it in a year or half a year. So, you know, as you know, mental health is a priority of ours. We've invested heavily and we'll continue to. And I think, you know, we'll work with the community to make this better.
Okay. So. Andrew, thanks for your time this morning.
Yep, thanks.
It's Park City School Board President Andrew Kaplan. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. KPCW News Time, 8:35. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Council meeting in work session starting at 5:30 tomorrow. In the studio with me, I've got City Manager Diane Foster along with Economic Development Manager Jonathan Weidenhammer. Good morning.
Good morning.
5:45, we've got a work session on the new transit signal and transit lane updates. We're talking about spending nearly $400,000, Diane, to install a traffic signal and priority control system. People are wondering, does it wash my car too?
That's an awesome idea. We should do that. You know, and actually, I believe 80% of this is reimbursable by the federal government. So it's a as with all of our transit equipment, we get reimbursed by the federal government, and it's a fantastic deal. And I'm super excited about these because we're talking about a couple of things here. The signal priority, so they're going to have new hardware and software on the buses that will allow the buses to be able to hold a light just for a couple seconds. And that'll make a big difference. You know, right now the Electric Express is doing about 11-minute runs between Kimball Junction and Old Town Transit Center, and that includes a stop at the Canyons and one at Fresh Market. And so to keep those times up, especially when we're talking about in winter traffic, that's going to be very important. In addition to that, we've got two items on the Electric Express. The other one is that the lanes, we're extending how far that the bus can use the lanes. And I do want to remind folks this winter, we're talking about putting cameras on the back of buses and things like that, because we do have cars that sometimes draft behind a bus and pull in there. And that's not only illegal, it's incredibly dangerous for the passengers on the bus. So we do want to encourage folks to not draft on buses. But the idea that UDOT's allowing us to use those lanes is just great.
And that's a special agreement between the city and UDOT to use it basically between White Pine Canyon Road
right,
and Kimball Junction.
And all the way to Kimball Junction.
That's where it bogs down?
It depends on, you know, I've driven home there for a number of years that way. And it depends on the time of day and the traffic, but you can get a backup at White Pine Canyon Road at that canyon's traffic light, particularly when skiers are unloading. And then often on other days, you can back up all the way to North Shore even or Bear Hollow. On that road. So the idea that you can get there more quickly through a bus, and now that the county is adding an additional, I believe it's in the area of like 52 spaces at the library, or actually at the transit center, so it'll act a little bit more as a park and ride. So that's a terrific option for folks.
And again, these bus lanes will be able to be used 24/7, not just between the hours of 1 and 8 p.m. like we have.
That's correct, and that's a big deal. And northbound and southbound, so both ways, because we know that now we've been getting some backup on 224 in the morning, particularly as you come into the canyons. So when we look at all of these are actually a precursor to eventually we hope to have a dedicated transit lane, so something that would have a little bit of a separation. I believe staff is leaning towards the idea, and their preference is having something along the right and left sides of the road in place of the breakdown lane. But I will remind folks that our elected officials, both city and county, have been very clear about we do not want to widen the roads for cars. Now, if you're adding a lane for a bus, that's a whole nother story.
Okay. And again, that study is underway.
That study is underway right now.
ValleyToMountainStudy.com or something like that.
Exactly.
Okay. You were scheduled to spend some time looking at the Main Street Plaza uses, Jonathan. This has been continued, however, till the October 12th meeting. How come? Just not quite ready?
No, I think we're ready to frame the discussion. It's a preliminary discussion. Again, when this started, it was the Brewpub Plaza was intended to take all the events that shut down Main Street and make sure we can still hold them and not kind of screw up day-to-day operations. That was in 2011 or 12, and we passed a resort sales tax to pay for the project. But through the conversation, as we've developed the plan, council's really been concerned about impacts on the neighborhood and bringing more impact and noise through the event process to the location. So we want to give them an opportunity to see if they're okay with the current land use and event process and noise ordinance regulating, or if they want to add some additional layers that they would have control over to set some thresholds for the plaza. And again, the reason for the delay is just to make sure we have the whole council there to hear the conversation.
And Councilmember Nan Worrell was the one who specifically requested this. And I think she's been at every city council meeting the entire year. And this is the one that she let us know about 4 months ago she wouldn't be here. So we wanted to make sure that because she was the initial requester that she was available.
Okay. The council's goals for the plaza really haven't changed?
No,
it's just the programming uses?
No, I would say they have changed. You know, again, when we started, we thought we were building up a plaza to facilitate and host events, bring more incremental people to the street. And the goals have shifted to be more of a plaza as the primary use, a park, a passive space with some events happening at it.
And so that's what the discussion would be framed in, is that how do we then process the special events that would take place on the plaza?
I think it's mostly about the events. You know, the staff, whether it's the rec staff or economic development staff, we don't have a goal. We don't have a program. We don't have an agenda to use it. Our intent and our recommendation is that we let our special event process and Jenny manage it. You know, we reply reactively to people who want to use it.
You outlined all of the events that have taken place on Main Street over the last several years. And what did you find? I mean, what information does that provide in you? I mean, can they be moved off the street onto the plaza?
And that was, yeah, it was a hard exercise for Jenny Dearson and I to go through in terms of trying to make some assumptions on how many events, how many event days, which ones do we think will then use the plaza. And we still built in a little bit of growth into it. So it was a pretty difficult exercise. But in general, I mean, what we're talking about is looking at the total events and the total event days and trying to put a cap on the biggies, right? The big, ugly ones with a lot of music and noise and a lot of impacts and a lot of traffic. It's looking at the music. You know, what hours are the music happening? Is it amplified music? If it is amplified, is it every Sunday for the whole summer? And trying to, you know, reduce impact or perceived impact of that. So say if the Silly Market wanted to move up there and they wanted to have music, we would say you should only do that between, say, noon and 5, and it shouldn't be that loud, right? So it's not this every day, all Sunday kind of recurring thing that would impact the neighborhood. So it's really framing the thresholds that we want council input on, you know, tell us what's too much, what's okay.
So there are 4 recommendations before the council. Anyone that the staff prefers?
Again, our preference, our recommendation is we think we have good land use process in place. We think we have a very good special event process in place, and we think we have a pretty darn good noise ordinance that we're working on how to enforce it, and we think we have good existing tools to handle it. But if you look at council's policy on how we handle the McPullen barn use, where council put over another layer, an administrative use policy on it, if they would like to do that, if they would like to further state their goals so that applicants and even more importantly the residential neighborhood around it is clear on what the expectation is and what the use parameters are, you know, we think they might want to do that. So we went ahead and drafted a potential kind of use policy so they could at least say either, yeah, we do or don't want to do that, and B, yeah, that's too much or not enough.
So is that the only place that we do use that administrative use policy there? Is at the McPullen Barn?
I think it's the only similar example, yes.
Okay, so it's really a decision. It would go through special events, and it's up to council to decide whether or not they want to have a final say in that decision-making process.
Right, and this is a great opportunity for the community to come out, because it's actually balancing, you know, a lot of what city council does is balance community needs, you know, balancing business needs. A lot of the Brewpub Plaza, if we'll go back to way back when, it was a response to 205 Main Street. So a lot of folks, even though that process was absolutely appropriate, a lot of people don't like that became residential. And so the idea was, would we bring vibrancy to the top of Main Street? Now there's a question about how much vibrancy, and I really appreciate the work that Jonathan and Jenny have done, because they brought council a number of different tools and choices about how do you want to implement that.
All right. Let's see. Again, that's going to be back next week.
Right,
but work session discussion.
It's good for us to talk about it and get folks to know that it's coming.
All right, real quick, the Historic District Grant Program, this has kind of been laying low and hasn't been used in the last couple of years. What's going on here?
So this is one where council, we made some tweaks to it because we wanted, you know, council really likes this program. It effectuates their goals. There was a couple of years ago, we made some tweaks to it. One of the things that was happening was that we had some folks coming in from out of town who were just buying them and flipping them and using the grant program. The reality is council said, you know what, that still effectuates our goals of preserving. However, they cut down the amount of reimbursement that could happen. Then, as with any kind of program, every now and then you want to look at it and refresh it. So we went out and hired someone who is a specialist in this area. And what we're providing to council is some draft recommendations. We're going to be holding a joint study session with the historic board and also the council.
Okay. Also, an update with regard to the transit app, MyStop. You'd had some problems with that. You've got it all working like it's supposed to?
We do. We did have some problems. And, you know, this is an interesting one because the city we work with, Avail Technologies, is the company that has the app, but also they do all the technology for our buses, so that if you go into our transit operation facility, we can see where every bus is on a screen, and they also do the counters. So one of the things, although the other piece is that this is all tied into Google as well. So it's really complicated technology, and it's got a front end and a middle layer and a back end. And so we were having some problems with it, and the developer came out and they spent a lot of time with us, so we think we've nailed that. That being said, if you do find a problem with the app, and we do want to know about it, you know, it's an incredibly complex system, please do contact us. Please just call City Hall and you can get a hold of our transit department.
Council will also be getting an update with regard to the parking technology progress. We're going to be talking with Kenzie Colson and Julie Dixon about that later on in the week, so I'm going to skip over that. But tell me about the agreement with regard to the Park City Film Studio. What's happening here?
This is, as most folks know, there was a lawsuit, and the resolution of it is that Gary Crandall is taking ownership of this. So there are a couple things happening. One is that the ownership, the MPD, is being assigned to Gary Crandall. And then the other thing is that staff is bringing a piece on the film studio's use of the park and ride lot. We want to, staff is recommending the council approve use of that for the Yellowstone filming, and also for parking their crew there. We think it's a good use of that parking lot, but that actually the MPD requires that council give the okay on that.
Do we get paid for the use
of
that?
We do.
Okay. All right. Anything else you wanted to mention real quick?
I will encourage folks to please come out to city council meetings. We've got a lot of interesting stuff coming up. We've got affordable housing study session coming up. County's going to be coming and talking with us. And most importantly for next week will be, please do come out and talk to us about what you think about the Main Street Plaza.
All right. Diane and Jonathan, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time, 8:46. Good morning. Well, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission met last night and made a positive recommendation with regard to the Canyon Spa Agreement. In the studio with a recap, Commissioner Canice Hart. Good morning, Canice.
Good morning, Leslie.
So after a year of meetings with regard to the Spa Canyons plan, you feel like you've achieved what?
Well, for anyone who's not familiar with this, the SPA, the specially planned area for the canyons, was created about 20 years ago. And so this is the first big change, the change to the whole specially planned area, or the amendment that was proposed. And we've been meeting on it for over a year, given the importance and significance of this. It was an interesting process to be a part of because we've seen a lot change from when we started to where we ended up last night. And it's one of those things like you probably never could be finished. Like you feel like you could just dive into more details. And every time you peel another layer of the onion back, there's something else there that you want to get into. But by and large, I think we got kind of the big pieces in order. And for anyone who hasn't seen what the developers are proposing, it's really a reconfiguration of buildings. Some moved, some not there, some taller, some road changes, but the idea or the intention is to allow people and skiers to just walk around the main village on a relatively flat surface to get to and from restaurants and shopping centers. It's kind of this idea of removing the parking from up there, so all the day skier activity has to happen down by the cabriolet, and then once you're up there in the village that you'd want to stay, that it has kind of everything you would need to enjoy a day of skiing up there.
So what was the concern about traffic that led you to adding an extra condition of approval?
Yeah, so there's a couple things. So fundamentally, you know, as the canyons builds out, you're just going to have more cars. And we're trying to reduce cars, actually. So by putting workforce housing at the bottom, the idea is that the employees' cars will stay down there and that now they'll take like a cabriolet or an inter-shuttle system up to the places that they work. So in some ways, this addition actually removes some of the traffic. And by removing the day skiers parking from up at the village, that removes traffic as well. But still, fundamentally, you're going to have more people up there and there'll be cars. Interesting enough, one of the main issues as traffic is coming in and out, like exiting the village or exiting the canyons, it's really 224 when they hit that. And so as the city and the, you know, Park City and the unincorporated areas and incorporated areas grow, we have more traffic on 224, which creates more of a bottleneck for people coming in and out of the canyons. And that's where we were kind of getting hung up a little bit was, you know, what could we actually control within this planned area versus what is out of our control that UDOT handles.
Right. But no changes to the cabriolet or any additional way to get up above the mountain. Now we've just added, you know, thousands more people, forcing them to ride up the cabriolet. So no consideration for that. I'm surprised.
Yeah, this is also kind of an interesting thing when you're working through this. It's a little bit of, well, that's not my responsibility. That's this other group, you know, deals with that. And so there's this kind of question of the specially planned area, the pieces that we're moving around, like buildings and, you know, roadways. But when it comes to skier operations, then it's Vail, and it's a separate conversation. But no, I mean, fundamentally, though, I see the same issue. The cabriolet stays the same. You know, you're pushing more day skiers down to the cabriolet to go up. You know, you're also – now, I don't think this would affect it, but you'd be talking about the workers using the cabriolet to get up. Now, they obviously need to be up to the mountain before the skiers would get there. But, you know, the use and the load on that would probably just really increase. And then up top, what you're looking at doing is, you know, you're still looking at the orange bubble and the gondola there, and you're talking about, what, 75% build out, more than what we have coming off those chairs. And so they're going to extend one of the chairlifts further down into the village, so that they can get more people up on the mountain there. But no, I've certainly, as a skier and someone who lives here, I have tons of questions around that.
Parking for employees, there is going to be some for those 1,100 pillows?
So in the area that, for anyone who hasn't seen the plans, there's an area down by the lower, or by the cabriolet, kind of off to the side of the parking, where they're going to build out condos and apartments for workforce housing. It'd be 11, as you just said, you know, 1,100 pillows or spaces. There is parking there. There's not a lot of parking in that it's not like a one-to-one ratio of everybody gets a parking space. But the thought is that most of the people that are coming to this, be like the people working at the canyons during the winter, a lot of people don't actually have a car. So there seems to be enough for what they're trying to do. And then there's some questions around what the right amount is.
And what about commercial space for employees? I mean, I know there's no planned grocery store. I mean, they'll just, it's the 7-Eleven?
No, actually, there is a planned grocery store, although I think the employees and the people around there might like a pub or a bar as much, if not more. So in the workforce housing, there's a corner of that space, if you will, which is slated for commercial. And I think what they've proposed or they envision is like a small regional market or something that would work there. I'm not sure how practical that is. I mean, I just think if I live there, I'd probably still go over to Smith's and, you know, do my shopping there. But that's why I say like a restaurant, a hangout spot, you know, places for people to hang out and congregate would be very useful.
The amended plan changes how buildings in the core are measured. It still sounds confusing. We heard that some buildings are going to be measured in elevation from sea level. Others will be measured in stories. How come?
You know, I'm not sure why. I mean, well, I'm sure as in they what they were saying is that they were asked to keep some of those buildings measured in stories. The ones that are measured in elevation are really important in that some people are opposed to the idea that of the building heights. You know, they'd like them to be shorter. Some of that is a misunderstanding of kind of what the previous arrangement was, and some of it is, you know, just they live there and they just don't want to have to see a building. But what the elevation does in those instances is it gives you an absolute. So what it, you know, then I think what you could argue is what should the elevation be? But at least with an elevation, there's no question about, well, how tall is the story, or is it off finish grade or existing grade? It's just, here's the absolute roof height, and this is where it's going to stop at. And so fundamentally, it's a good thing, although it opens up a couple doors. Like, you can build below it. There's not a limitation on stories. So massing could be bigger.
Yeah. Concerned by existing property owners that the new height measures are going to lower their property values. Any justification in that?
Well, there's two parts. I mean, one is from a planning commission, we can actually not allow to consider property values. And then I think this is one where I've heard people argue that their property values are going to increase as being part of the overall growth and development of the canyons. And I've heard people say that the property value is going to decrease because a view will be obstructed. So, you know, what will actually happen, we'll find out as the market will tell us. But, no, you know, I think some of it, there's one fundamental thing in the existing specially planned area in the development agreement. It's says all these buildings are built off of finish grade. And that's a really key phrase. And I'm not sure why they put that in there. But what that means is for anyone who's not familiar with finish grade, but as a developer, say, puts dirt into a space, they can build off of the top of that. So arguably, you could have a single story be taller than some of these tall buildings if there's enough dirt there. So they left that open when they put that in the development agreement 20 years ago. And so that was a key part. And I think the other one on the elevation is, you know, you imagine a hillside, you're going to take from the high power end of your hill and you're going to build straight out to get a level first floor. And like use Westgate as a quick example. It's 5.5 stories, yet you could be on the 7th floor. So they came out off the high point, they started building up, and then they built below what was that first floor, but they had labeled or numbered the lower floors 1, 2, 3. So you could be on the 7th floor and have a 4th floor be taller than you as a result of that.
Okay, I need to leave it there. Candace, thanks for your time. Candace Howard, a member of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. This is the KPCW Local News Hour.
Thanks.
Well, Friday's the last day to beat the call from the Park City Education Foundation. In the studio to tell us what that means, I have Jen Bellow. She is the Director of Communications and Marketing for the Education Foundation. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie.
So what does this mean?
So as everyone probably knows, we have a phone-a-thon late in October. And if you don't want us to call you, you can beat the call and donate by this Friday. We ask all parents to give to help fund the $1 million in programs we provide to the school district every year. We can't do it without their donations. We don't have an endowment. So it's really important for every parent to give just what they can.
So if you will avoid the call by any amount or do you?
Any amount.
Okay.
Any amount. We do ask for the dollar per school day, $180 per student, but Beat the Call is all about participation. So there's prizes at the schools. Each elementary grade can win a pizza party if they're the highest participating class. There is a $2,500 grant from the UPS Stores Park City for the school with the highest participation. Any amount counts.
So who do you call? Everybody in the school district or just existing parents?
Existing parents. So if you are a parent and you've already given, again, any amount by this Friday, we won't call you or a student won't call you. Students call.
So it's PCEF.org?
PCEF4kids.org.
All right. And then what are you going to do with the money?
So this year, last year, we funded about $1.5 million in programs. We will probably fund about that much again. That's what we've committed to the school district. They range from everything from elementary coding and elementary art to robotics to music, STEM programs, Bright Futures. There's 100 programs from preschool to post high school. That's a lot. Your kid is affected by it if you have a student in the school district. And so we can't do it without full participation from the generous parents.
Okay. What's the average contribution that you get?
So during Beat the Call, the average contribution is actually about, I think, about $80. So it's actually fairly substantial. So we really appreciate that.
Okay. Well, avoid the phone call and PCEF4kids.org. By the end of day Friday.
By the end of day Friday, right.
Okay. Jen, hey, thanks.
Thank you, Leslie.
That's Jen Bellow.